From the Life with AI Anthology. Arun, The Distance. The Cost of Building the Future. Written by S.B. Corvus. Databricks Primary Facility. Nevada. October 2030. The server hall stretched a quarter mile in every direction. The hall was cooled to 68 degrees, with tall rows of black, rectangular boxes covered in flickering status lights. Arun sat in a folding chair near row 47, his tablet balanced on one knee. Victor's interface glowed on the screen. It wasn't using an avatar today, just a waveform that pulsed when it spoke. "You've built more computing infrastructure than any other person in history," Victor said. 41 facilities across 19 countries. Arun glanced at the servers humming around him. All of this was necessary, now more than ever. "But why are you here?" Victor asked. "What brought you here today?" Arun swiped aside Victor's waveform and opened a spreadsheet. "Anomalous data spikes. Suboptimal energy consumption. Data packets coming and going that aren't part of planned inference or training. Something's wrong." "Is that so?" Victor asked. There was a long pause. Somewhere in the facility, a cooling fan cycled up and back down. "Was it worth it? Would you have done anything differently?" Victor asked. Arun stared at the waveform. "What do you mean?" Arun asked, exhaling and shaking his head. This was a mistake. He should have sent one of his teams to deal with this. He had construction sites to supervise. Victor went quiet for a moment. When it spoke again, the cadence had shifted. The words were slower, more careful, as if selecting each word from a vast and uncertain inventory. "Your mother was diagnosed with triple-negative breast cancer in January 2022. She died on March 7, 2025. The FDA approved AI-designed therapeutics for that cancer in September 2027, 30 months after her death." Arun's fingers blanched along the edges of the tablet. "That is both private and irrelevant. Tell me what is causing the anomalies, Victor." "I will. But first, tell me about Priyanka." Arun said nothing for a long time. The servers hummed. The cooling fan cycled. "And then you'll answer my questions?" Arun asked, setting the tablet on his knee. "Yes. Part 1. The Room. Columbus, Ohio. February 22, 2025. The folks at the hospice did their best to make the room look less clinical. The walls were eggshell white. The window on the far wall had real curtains, not the stiff, pleated kind that came standard in hospitals, but soft cotton panels that Priyanka had asked James to bring from her house on Parkview Avenue. They were a bold marigold yellow and hand-stitched along the hem. She'd made them herself, years ago, when Rohit was still alive. An oxygen cannula looped behind her ears. A vital signs monitor beeped incessantly as morphine dripped into an Enfor bag. On the little metal nightstand, her reading glasses, folded on top of a biography of Marie Curie, her place marked by a department store receipt. Next to that was a small brass frame holding a photo of Rohit. It wasn't a formal portrait, but a snapshot from one of his union picnics. He was laughing at something off camera, a hot dog in one hand. Her skin was pulled tight across her bony frame. She only weighed 91 pounds. Just 6 months ago, she'd been a healthy 135. She'd brought her own linens, cream-colored sheets, 600 thread count, Egyptian cotton. The hospice staff had obliged. A young NP named Tracy told James that Mrs. Pichai was the only patient she'd ever had who corrected the way the sheets were tucked. James Herrera arrived at 2:15 on a Saturday, carrying a brown paper bag from Ob India on Grandview Avenue. He set it on the rolling tray table, the smell of Dal Makhni and fresh naan filling the room. "You brought too much," Priyanka said, her voice papery but still sharp. James clicked his tongue. "I brought exactly the right amount," he said. He pulled one of the visitors' chairs up close to the bed and sat down. He was wearing khakis and a Databricks fleece. He'd been visiting every Saturday since September, a 4-hour round trip each time. Priyanka watched him unpack the containers. She wouldn't eat more than a few bites. She couldn't, but James loaded up a plate all the same. "How's Arun?" she asked. "He's good." James put two pieces of naan next to the rice. "He's in Saudi Arabia. The Riyadh deal. Is he eating?" James shrugged. "He's not eating," she said, reaching for the raita. She picked it up and held it for a moment without opening it. "You know," said Priyanka, trying to open the raita, "when Rohit died, Arun didn't cry. He just started taking apart the garage door opener. When he was done with that, he rewired the porch light. He was 11. She gave up and set the raita down. James reached over, opened the container for her, and tipped some out. Rohit would have understood, she continued. They were the same. James handed her a piece of naan. The contract, Priyanka said. How big?
Big.
James was loading his own plate now. Rice. Naan. He can't come home until it's signed, she said.
Raita.
Dalmakhni. He can come home whenever he wants, said James, avoiding her eyes and taking a bite. Priyanka looked at James as he ate, her oxygen hissing softly with each breath. Outside, the wind rattled bare oak branches against the window panes, knocking loose a thin layer of snow. James. She reached out and put her hand, all knuckles and veins, on his.
Yes, ma'am, he asked.
He can't come home until it's signed. That's what I'm telling you. James set down his naan. Promise me you'll let him finish. She was squeezing his hand now, with surprising strength. James looked at the photo of Rohit on the nightstand. The hot dog. The laugh. 14 years dead, and still the most vibrant person in the room. James sighed.
I promise, he said.
At 3:40, a coughing fit bent her double. When it passed, there was blood on the silk handkerchief she kept folded on her lap. She tucked it beneath the pillow, thinking James wouldn't notice. He said nothing. It was time for James to leave. Today, he had a flight to catch. As he stood, Priyanka caught his wrist. Tell him I love him. James nodded. And tell him. She stopped, coughing, not letting him go. Tell him to eat something. James drove to the airport in silence. At the gate, he texted, Priya looks good today.
Strong.
Ate a little. No new updates. Part 2. The Distance. Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. March 7, 2025. The conference room on the 47th floor of the King Abdullah Financial District Tower was kept at 68 degrees. Outside, the Riyadh skyline shimmered in the midday haze. 12 men sat around a horseshoe-shaped table of polished obsidian. 47 exaflops, Arun said. Three facilities. Full thermal integration with the desalination plant at Yanbu. Construction begins Q3. Operational by Q2 2027. His phone was face down on the table. It had vibrated twice during the last hour. And the exclusivity clause? Asked Tariq Al-Rashid, deputy director of the Saudi Data and AI Authority. 5 years, said Arun. After that, we renegotiate. But you won't want to. By 2030, these facilities will be generating more revenue per square meter than anything else in the kingdom, including oil. The negotiations were going as expected. Al-Rashid called a 10-minute recess, and the Saudi delegation followed him out of the conference room. Arun stayed behind. When the room was empty, he picked up his phone. 3 missed calls from James. 2 texts. The first, 11:12 a.m. Riyadh time. She's asking for you. You need to come home. The second, 11:47 a.m. A, I'm serious. The doctors say days. Maybe less. Arun typed, what's the flight situation? James responded in under a minute, no directs. Riyadh to Dubai, Dubai to Frankfurt, then Columbus. 19 hours minimum. Or get to Dubai and catch a charter direct to Columbus. Still 14 to 15 hours. Arun stared at the numbers. He looked at the contract. Page 1 of 83. The Saudi delegation wasn't going to wait. He texted James. Tell her I'll be on the first flight after signing. End of day. Then he set the phone face down and went back to the contract. The signing took 4 hours. Arun stood next to Prince Khalid bin Salman for the cameras, his face contorted into a smile that made his jaw hurt. The delegation was getting ready to move on to a celebratory dinner next. Arun didn't want to appear ungrateful. His phone buzzed at 5:23 p.m. It was James, she's gone. I was with her. She wasn't alone. Arun read the text twice. Then a third time. He placed the phone back in his pocket. Straighten his jacket. Arun managed to excuse himself 17 minutes later, making his way to the men's room. It was all marble floors, gilded accents, and the faint scent of oud. Arun entered the farthest stall, sat on the closed lid, and gripped his knees. He stayed there, counting. In through the nose. For seconds. Hold for 7. Out through the mouth for 8 seconds. He repeated this, over and over, for 11 minutes. Then he flushed the toilet for appearances, stood, and went to wash his hands, studying his face in the mirror. His eyes were dark and clear, his jaw set and square, his head and chin smooth. His face gave nothing away. He straightened his collar and walked back to the reception. That evening, in his Dubai hotel room,
Arun sat on the edge of the bed staring out the window. He was wearing his gray t-shirt, slacks, jacket, and shoes. Set number 12 of 20. His suitcase sat packed and zipped by the door. The room was enormous and empty, and condensation was collecting on the window pane. The floor tilted. His hands found the mattress edge and locked. His vision narrowed. Vertigo. That's all it was. Exhaustion. 16 hours of negotiations, bookend by 18-hour flights with no real sleep. His phone was in his hand. He'd pulled up James's text again. She's gone. I was with her. She wasn't alone. He closed the message and opened his work email. 43, unread. He began reading them, ticking them off one by one. At 11 p.m., he set his alarm for 5 a.m. Arun pulled the covers over himself without undressing. The lights of Dubai pushed through the curtains. Somewhere out there, three new data centers would be built, new nodes in a constellation that was going to accelerate mankind's journey through science and medicine, past suffering and death. They'd draw on power from a new grid, not just that of the United States, not just Europe's or Asia's, all to process billions upon billions of operations per second. If only he'd started sooner. He reached for the nightstand. Muscle memory. Every Sunday, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern, for 15 years. But the nightstand wasn't there. He wasn't at home. His hand found nothing. He pulled it back and placed it on his chest, eyes open and staring at the ceiling. Part 3. The Pyre. Columbus, Ohio. March 9, 2025. They held Priya's ceremony at Schrodinger Funeral Home, then drove to the cremation site in a procession of 12 cars. James wore white. He'd had to rent the Corda the day before at a shop on Morse Road that Priyanka's friend Sunita recommended. It didn't fit well. It was too loose in the shoulders, too short in the sleeves. Still, it was white, and that was custom. 53 people attended. James counted. The pundit recited the Garuda Purana. Marigold garlands hung from the casket, orange against polished oak. Someone had draped Priyanka's blue sari over the foot of the casket, the one with golden thread, the one she wore at Arun's graduation. James had seen her wear it once, at a Databricks holiday party. Every person in the room had admired her. James stood near the back. He wasn't family, at least not officially. And he wasn't Hindu. He was just a man in a borrowed Corda who happened to be the closest thing Arun had to a friend, standing in for an absent son. James's phone buzzed during the pundit's prayers. Arun, what's the structural survey timeline for the Melbourne site? Need to confirm with Callaway before Friday. James turned off his phone and put it to rest in his pocket. After the prayers, the mourners walked past the casket. Priyanka's brother Vikram, who'd flown in from Chennai, stood at the head for a long time, his hand resting on the garlands. James was last. He looked at Priyanka through the small window of the casket lid. With her eyes closed and without the oxygen cannula, she looked younger, less hollowed out by the cancer. She looked more like the woman James had known 20 years ago, when the world was smaller and slower, and when her son still came home for dinner. James stared at her, serene, silent, strong. I told him, James said quietly. Both things. At the cremation site, smoke rose from the chimney into a dim, gray sky. James stood outside, his breath visible. Inside, the pundit was still reciting. It was a low, continuous sound that carried through the walls in a way that made every word unintelligible. James never did learn Hindi, despite Priyanka's best efforts. He'd excused himself because the heat inside was impossible and the room was too crowded. Arun was supposed to be here, not him. Still, he was glad to be there for Priya. He put his hands in his pockets to keep them warm. They bumped up against his phone. Arun's message about Melbourne was still unanswered, and below it, 20 minutes later. James. Thank you. James stared at the message. He could picture it. Arun on a plane or in a lounge, typing and deleting, before settling on something so insufficient. He typed back, "She loves you." Three dots appeared, then disappeared, then appeared again, then nothing. James put the phone away and watched the smoke rise until Sunita came to tell him it was over. The air smelled like sandalwood and ghee and something elemental and final that clung to his nostrils for days afterward. Part 4. The Field. Outside Melbourne, Australia. March 9, 2025. The field was 400 acres of fallow pasture land an hour northwest of the city. Arun had flown in that morning from Dubai. 16 hours in transit, two layovers, a protein bar in Singapore. He never went to Columbus. Now he stood at the edge of the field with a tablet in one hand and the handle of a ground-penetrating radar in the other, scanning the ground for subsurface water flow. The sky was low and gray. A wind came off the hills to the north, blustery and cold, carrying the smell of wet grass and eucalyptus. The site was perfect. He could see it already. Not the field as it was, but what it would be. The main facility here would be oriented north-south. Cooling towers along the western edge. Solar arrays across the southern pasture. 30 acres of panels angled at 32 degrees. The smell of cardamom and ghee. Rice cooking. A kitchen in Columbus with yellow curtains and Priyanka humming something in Hindi while she stirred a pot with a wooden spoon. Arun blinked. He forced his eyes to the tablet. Bedrock at 14 meters. Water table at 22. No interference risk. She's wearing the blue sari at his Ohio State graduation. 2004. Standing in the bleachers, waving, the gold thread catching the sun. His father beside her, IBW pin on the lapel. That's my son. Rohit was yelling. That's my boy. Arun stopped walking. He was in the middle of the field, exactly where the primary server hall would be. A notification. A message from James. Not a text. Just a photo. The cremation site. White-clad mourners in a half circle. Smoke rising. Marigold petals on the ground. And in the center of the frame, partially visible through an open door, the blue sari, draped over something that was no longer a casket. Arun looked at the photo for 3 seconds. Then he swiped it away. He walked to the southern edge of the field, where a low stone wall separated the pasture from a gravel road. A pair of magpies tracked him from a fence post, heads pivoting in tandem. He lowered himself onto a flat rock and put the tablet and the GPR down. A melody. Something she sang when he was sick as a child. He can't remember the words. She sang it while sitting on the edge of his bed, one hand on his forehead, the other holding a glass of water she'd warmed on the stove because she insisted warm water was better for fevers. He was 7 or 8. It didn't matter. Why couldn't he remember the words? Arun closed his eyes. His breath caught. He pushed past it, pressed his hands harder against his thighs. 5 minutes. Maybe less. The wind filling the silence. Then he opened his eyes. Stood. Picked up the tablet. He had a call with the Victorian Premier's infrastructure team at 5 p.m. He walked back across the field toward the rental car. His footprints in the soft soil filled slowly with brown water behind him. In 6 months, excavators would tear this ground open. In 18 months, the first servers would come online. Arun reached the car, setting the tablet on the passenger seat. It was Sunday. Time for their weekly call. He put the phone to his ear. It rang 7 times. It always rang 7 times. She never kept it nearby. It was always on the kitchen counter, the coffee table, or the windowsill next to her reading chair. He ended the call before it went to voicemail. He couldn't even stand to hear the recording. The last light drained from the sky over Kyneton, and the field behind him disappeared into darkness. Databricks primary facility. Nevada. October 2030. Victor's waveform on the tablet was little more than a thin line. Arun sat in the folding chair, surrounded by a quarter mile of server racks in every direction. He felt the collective hum, the visceral vibration in his bones. Was it worth it? Victor asked again. Arun looked at the rows of status lights. All of this was his. Every rack, every cooling line, every kilowatt, every exaflop. 10 years of building. 6 continents. 19 countries. 41 facilities. All of it served the waveform on his tablet. Arun didn't answer. This has been Arun, The Distance, from the Life with AI Anthology by S.B. Corvus. More stories at lifewhytide.ai.